36. Bayat Watcher. Sergeant Peter Russo knew why he had volunteered for this job. In many ways, it was a realization of a childhood dream. He had become fascinated by telescopes when he was only 6 or 7 years old, and much of his youth had been spent collecting lenses of all shapes and sizes. These he had mounted in cardboard tubes, making instruments of ever-increasing power until he was familiar with the moon and planets, the nearer space stations, and the entire landscape within 30 kilometers of his home. He had been lucky in his place of birth, among the mountains of Colorado. In almost every direction, the view was spectacular and inexhaustible. He had spent hours exploring, in perfect safety, the peaks that every year took their toll of careless climbers. Though he had seen much, he had imagined even more. He had liked to pretend that over each crest of rock, beyond the reach of his telescope, were magic kingdoms full of wonderful creatures. And so for years he had avoided visiting the places his lenses brought to him, because he knew that the reality could not live up to the dream. Now, on the central axis of Rama, he could survey marvels beyond the wildest fantasies of his youth. A whole world lay spread out before him. A small one, it was true, yet a man could spend a lifetime exploring 4,000 square kilometers, even when it was dead and changeless. But now life, with all its infinite possibilities, had come to Rama. If the biological robots were not living creatures, they were certainly very good imitations. No one knew who invented the word Bayat. It seemed to come into instant use by a kind of spontaneous generation. From his vantage point on the hub, Russo was Bayat Watcher-in-Chief, and he was beginning, so he believed, to understand some of their behavior patterns. The spiders were mobile sensors, using vision and probably touch to examine the whole interior of Rama. At one time, there had been hundreds of them rushing around at high speed, but after less than 2 days, most had disappeared. Now it was quite unusual to see even one. They had been replaced by a whole menagerie of much more impressive creatures, and it had been no minor task to think of suitable names for them. There were the window cleaners, with large, padded feet, who were apparently polishing their way the whole length of Rama's 6 artificial suns. Their enormous shadows, cast right across the diameter of the world, sometimes caused temporary eclipses on the far side. The crab that had demolished Dragonfly seemed to be a scavenger. A relay chain of identical creatures had approached Camp Alpha and carried off all the debris that had been neatly stacked on the outskirts. They would have carried off everything else if Norton and Mercer had not stood firm and defied them. The confrontation had been anxious, but brief. Thereafter, the scavengers seemed to understand what they were allowed to touch, and arrived at regular intervals to see if their services were required. It was a most convenient arrangement, and indicated a high degree of intelligence on the part of either the scavengers themselves or some controlling entity elsewhere. Garbage disposal on Rama was simple. Everything was thrown into the sea, where it was presumably broken down into forms that could be used again. The process was rapid. Resolution had disappeared overnight, to the great annoyance of Ruby Barnes. Norton had consoled her by pointing out that it had done its job magnificently, and he would never have allowed anyone to use it again. The sharks might not be as discriminating as the scavengers. No astronomer discovering an unknown planet could have been happier than Russo was when he spotted a new type of biot and secured a good photo of it through his telescope. Unfortunately, it seemed that all the interesting species were over at the South Pole, where they were performing mysterious tasks around the horns. Something that looked like a centipede with suction pads could be seen from time to time exploring Bighorn itself, while Rousseau had caught a glimpse of a burly creature around the lower peaks that could have been a cross between a hippopotamus and a bulldozer. And there was even a double-necked giraffe, which apparently acted as a mobile crane. Presumably, Rama, like any ship, required testing, checking, and repairing after its immense voyage. The crew was already hard at work. When would the passengers appear? Biot classifying was not Rousseau's main job. His orders were to keep watch on the two or three exploring parties that were always out, to see that they did not get into trouble, and to warn them if anything approached. He alternated every 6 hours with anyone else who could be spared, though more than once he had been on duty for 12 hours at a stretch. As a result, he now knew the geography of Rama better than any other man who would ever live. It was as familiar to him as the Colorado mountains of his youth. When Lieutenant Commander Kirchhoff emerged from Airlock Alpha, Rousseau knew at once that something unusual was happening. Personnel transfers never occurred during the sleeping period, and it was now past midnight by mission time. Then Rousseau remembered how short-handed they were, and was shocked by a much more startling irregularity. "Jerry? Who's in charge of the ship?" "I am," said the exec coldly as he flipped open his helmet. "You don't think I'd leave the bridge while I'm on watch, do you?" He reached into his suit carry-all and pulled out a small can bearing the label, "Concentrated Orange Juice, to make 5 liters. "You're good at this, Peter. The skipper is waiting for it." Rousseau hefted the can, then said, "I hope you've put enough mass inside it. Sometimes they get stuck on the first terrace." "Well, you're the expert." That was true enough. The hub observers had had plenty of practice sending down small items that had been forgotten or were needed in a hurry. The trick was to get them safely past the low-gravity region, and then to see that the Coriolis effect did not carry them too far away from the camp during the 8-kilometer roll downhill. Rousseau anchored himself firmly, grasped the can, and hurled it down the face of the cliff. He did not aim directly toward Camp Alpha, but almost 30 degrees away from it. Almost immediately, air resistance robbed the can of its initial speed, but then the pseudo-gravity of Rama took over, and it started to move downward at a constant velocity. It hit once near the base of the ladder and did a slow-motion bounce, which took it clear of the first terrace. "It's okay now," said Rousseau. "Like to make a bet?" "No," was the prompt reply. "You know the odds." "You're no sportsman. But I'll tell you now, it will stop within 300 meters of the camp." "That doesn't sound very close." "You might try it sometime. I once saw Joe miss by a couple of kilometers." The can was no longer bouncing. Gravity had become strong enough to glue it to the curving face of the North Dome. By the time it had reached the second terrace, it was rolling along at 20 or 30 kilometers an hour, and had reached nearly the maximum speed that friction would allow. "Now we'll have to wait," said Rousseau, seating himself at the telescope so that he could keep track of the messenger. "It will be there in 10 minutes. Ah, here comes the skipper. I've got used to recognizing people from this angle. Now he's looking up at us." "I believe that telescope gives you a sense of power." Oh, it does. I'm the only person who knows everything that's happening in Rama. At least, I thought I did, he added plaintively, giving Kirchhoff a reproachful look. If it will keep you happy, the skipper found he'd run out of toothpaste. After that, conversation languished, but at last Rousseau said, "Wish you'd taken that bet. He's only got to walk 50 meters. Now he sees it. Mission complete. Thanks, Peter. A very good job. Now you can go back to sleep." "Sleep? I'm on watch until 0400. Sorry. You must have been sleeping. Or how else could you have dreamed all this?" Space Survey Headquarters to Commander SSS Endeavor. Priority AAA. Classification, your eyes only. No permanent record. Space Guard reports ultra-high-speed vehicle apparently launched Mercury 10 to 12 days ago on Rama Intercept. If no orbit change, arrival predicted, date 322 days, 15 hours. May be necessary you evacuate before then. Will advise further. C. Norton read the message half a dozen times to memorize the date. It was hard to keep track of time inside Rama. He had to look at his calendar watch to see that it was now day 315. That might leave them only 1 week. The message was chilling, not only for what it said, but also for what it implied. The Hermians had made a clandestine launch, which in itself was a breach of space law. The conclusion was obvious. Their vehicle could only be a missile. But why? It was inconceivable, well, almost inconceivable, that they would risk endangering Endeavor. So presumably he would receive ample warning from the Hermians themselves. In an emergency, he could leave at a few hours' notice, though he would do so only under extreme protest, at the direct orders of the Commander-in-Chief. Slowly and thoughtfully, he walked across to the improvised life support complex and dropped the message into an electrosan. The brilliant flare of laser light bursting out through the crack beneath the seat cover told him that the demands of security were satisfied. It was too bad, he told himself, that all problems could not be disposed of so swiftly and hygienically.